Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and the club's YouTube channel. I'm Alexandra Sewich Bass, U.S. Technology Editor for The Economist and your moderator for tonight's program. It's my pleasure to introduce you to tonight's distinguished guest, Tom Siebel, founder and CEO of C3 and one of the Valley's most successful and distinguished entrepreneurs. Tom has spent four decades working at the forefront of technology. He pioneered the field of customer relationship management, otherwise known as CRM, and was previously chairman and CEO of Siebel Systems, which merged with Oracle in 2006. His new firm, C3, offers clients a software platform that uses sensor data and AI for a variety of purposes, including predictive maintenance, fraud detection, energy management, customer engagement, and more. And we'll be speaking about that tonight. Tom has an admirable quality, and I always enjoy speaking with him because he sees both the big picture and the smallest details, and he never shies away from making provocative statements about the future of technology and our world. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tom Siebel.
Thank you.
So, Tom, I would like to start with a foundational question for our conversation. I know we're in San Francisco, so probably many of you in the front row could give me a very persuasive definition of what AI is. But for those of you who wouldn't want to venture, I'd like to ask you, Tom, could you, when we talk about AI in a practical sense, what do you mean and what should we understand for future dinner party conversations?
Well, AI is a concept that goes back to the earliest days of computing at Bell Labs and the Alan Turing. And Alan Turing conceived of an idea called the Turing test. And this is shortly after the invention of the transistor. So this would be the early 50s. And he thought that someday that we would have computers that would pass the Turing test. And a Turing test would be a computer that, were we to interact with it, it would be indistinguishable from interacting with a human. So this is kind of where it began. And then in the 50s, there's a lot of work done at MIT by Marvin Minsky and others where they thought that computers could emulate what the human brain does. And then nothing happened for about 50 years. And 60 years, that was called kind of the winter of AI. Now we have a new step function of information technology that's come online with the advent of elastic cloud computing that offers almost infinite computing and storage capacity at very low cost, the concepts of big data, and then the underlying mathematical theory of AI that now, with these enabling technologies, we're able to solve classes of problems that were never solvable before. So there's a concept of general AI, which is what they talk about with like this DeepMind group in Google, which is the idea of computers that are indistinguishable or maybe superior to humans.
That could pass the Turing test.
That could pass the Turing test. And this would get you to the movies like Ex Machina and all the scary stuff out there. And then you have what the practical AI, what's really going on today. And AI is about, at the practical level, is not that scary. And it's simply using, we can now use computers to solve problems that were previously unsolvable in the area of doing predictions and doing predictions quite accurately. Mm-hmm. So historically, computers would execute algorithms over and over again, and every time they executed an algorithm, you'd get the same answer. Now with AI, we have self-learning algorithms that get better and better every time they fire, and we're able to predict things with high levels of precision, like when a device might fail, when a person might come down with a disease, what you might like to purchase next on Amazon. So in general, you're looking at prediction machines, as state of the art in, as of November 1st, I think it is, 2018, is doing predictions.
And what's the most human-like AI experience you have had in your career?
I don't think I've experienced a human-like AI experience, candidly. I'm unaware of one. I think that, you know, there's this concept of the singularity, which gets to this idea of when computers become more capable or smarter than human beings. And I don't think that happens anytime soon. I think the people who think about that underestimate the capacity of human beings. And they're thinking mostly about having computers that try to emulate what the brain does. And I think that there's much more than our brains that go into the cognitive and creative process. I think it's the entire organism, the endocrine systems, the hormonal systems, the flora in our gut, all that goes into being a human being and cognition and creativity. So I think we'll have computers very soon that can do any given task better than we can. For example, we have computers that can play Go better than a human being. We have computers that can play chess better than Garry Kasparov. We can have computers that could soon that will drive a car better than any of us in the room. But we won't have computers that can play chess and Go. And so that's the difference.
Do you think that we'll have another AI winter? We've been in full summer for the last few years. People are so excited about AI, splattered across newspapers with headlines about what AI is capable of. But it may well be that the public turns or researchers hit a wall. Do you worry about another winter?
Oh, I think that right now we're in this new field of AI. I think the cell has divided about four times, and in the next 30 years, this is going to be quite explosive. And so in the area, when I first went to work in the information technology business, would have been 1983, you know, the worldwide market for information technology was about $500 million. Today, it's about $3 trillion. I think that, you know, the predictions for just software in AI in the Internet of Things, this is a $250 billion software market in 2023, which is a blink of an eye. PwC just published a report this week. They expect in basically the next 10 years for AI to add, you know, $15 trillion to the global GDP. That's roughly 20%. Global GDP is about $80 trillion today. So this is big. McKinsey predicts that AI will add 1.2% to GDP growth in the United States for the next decade, for the foreseeable future. So I think what's going on with elastic cloud computing, AI, and IoT looks like an entire replacement market for everything that's taken place in the last 50 years of computing.
So good times ahead for the field of AI and business.
Staggeringly large.
Okay. What about for society? I want to come back because you have a lot of insights on the business world and the applications of AI. But I think a lot of people in this room want to know what it means for society. 10 or 15 years from now, do you think the middle class will be better or worse off because of AI?
Oh, I think it will be better. In other words, I think we will be healthier. We will live longer. The largest application of AI will be precision medicine. And the social and economic implications for that will be staggering in disease prevention, disease prevention, in, you know, genome-specific protocols. In AI-assisted medicine, we will be healthier, we will live longer, our vendors will provide us better service, whether it's a bank or an insurance company. Our product providers will anticipate our needs and deliver to our doorstep the product that we didn't know we wanted to buy, but you did. And so I think in general, energy will be safer, energy will be cleaner, okay, the world will be safer. So I think in general it's good things. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't some, very important deleterious consequences, potential consequences that we need to be cognizant of. And so there is a downside to this.
You didn't mention jobs. So will we be receiving all of these things we didn't know we wanted to buy while we're surviving on a universal basic income and reading the New York Times or The Economist with all our free time because we've been put out of work? Or what do you think the future holds for jobs and income?
Well, I think that is one of the important topics. I think something like 3 million people in the United States that basically depend on driving for the job for their jobs, and those jobs are going to go away. And the idea that we're going to retrain taxi drivers in New York City to be data scientists, this is not going to happen. So it's McKinsey estimates that we're going to lose, 400 million jobs due to automation, in the next 10 years. So this is a real problem. There are a lot of people who are going to be displaced. A lot of people are going to be potentially unemployable. Mm. So these issues need to be addressed. They need to be addressed through, I think, the education system, primarily the K-12 education system. But these are troubling issues. I think the idea of a universal basic income is a very scary idea. It's kind of the way they do it in Saudi Arabia, where they just distribute money to everybody and nobody works. I think that it takes a lot of the meaning out of life, and it steals the opportunity to have for people to have a sense of self-worth and purpose. So I think that's a pretty scary idea.
What do you think that parents should tell their kids? What advice should they give them if they want their teenagers to future-proof their careers from AI?
Go to college, get a job.
Is that enough?
That's it. Go to college, get a job, learn to read. I think we're in an era where computer skills are becoming a fundamental skill, like reading, writing, and arithmetic.
But of course, even people with advanced degrees are at risk. One of the classic examples is radiology, where computers are becoming better than humans at doing that, right? Especially in a field like medicine, where you say the applications will be and the gains will be so enormous. Won't people be at risk even with college degrees?
I think that I'm not buying, the IBM Watson ad, okay, that we're going to use, that AI is going to replace physicians. It's not going to happen. But I think AI will assist physicians. So I believe that we will have AI-assisted medicine, okay, that will help inform physicians as it relates to diagnosis, diagnoses, whether it's interpreting radiology or whatever it might be, CAT scans and what have you. So the idea that we're going to replace a physician with an AI model, I don't believe it, and I don't think it's a good idea.
Okay. Tell me about your views on precision medicine and what the future holds there.
Precision medicine, I think this will be the largest application of AI. I'm quite confident of that. And I think it has enormous benefits. At the same time, I'm going to talk about some of the things that we need to worry about. I mean, it is within our capacity to take the population of the United States, roughly 330 million people, and aggregate all of their healthcare history, their genome sequences, all of their pharmacology, radiology, all of the telemetry from CAT scans and from blood chemistry and electroencephalograms or whatever it might be, and aggregate those data into a unified federated image. We'll be able to apply AI to these data and do things like disease prediction. We'll be able to predict with very high levels of precision which of us will be diagnosed with name the disease in the next 5 years. Say diabetes or prostate cancer or whatever it might be. I think that particularly when we have the genome sequences, we will have the ability for basically, you know, genome-specific and individual-specific medical protocols for disease, for treatment protocols. We will be able to predict adverse drug reaction with high levels of precision. An example of adverse drug reaction would be addiction. That is an adverse drug reaction. And we'll be able to tell of the U.S. population, should we prescribe opiates to these people, who's predisposed for addiction, and we can avoid that problem. Again, we've talked about AI-assisted medicine, so people will be healthier. They will live longer. Okay, now what could possibly go wrong? Let's think about this. We have a database, and whether this is the government or this is our insurance provider, I mean, they're going to know, you know, what disease, perhaps terminal disease, that we're going to be diagnosed with in the next 3 years. And maybe some of us would just as soon not know that. So I mean, this creates some real ethical problems. I mean, what does one do with that information? And what will that insurance company do with that information, or your government do with that information? Who needs to worry about pre-existing conditions when we know what you're going to come down with in the next 3 years? Mm. So as it relates to rates, okay, and access to health care. So I think there's some real troubling consequences associated with precision medicine that today we have no constructs for dealing with.
Mm-hmm. You all have a lot of great questions, and I'm going to get fed them throughout our talk. So I'm going to bring in one because it relates to what we were talking about the capabilities of AI, just again as a foundational question. In this universe, is it possible to make a machine 10x smarter than the human brain today?
Today? No way. We're not even close.
What would you say we're at?
The mealworm. Okay.
That's depressing.
Okay. A mealworm. That's, I think, about where we're at. I think people underestimate the capacity of the human being, and I mean the whole of the human being. Okay.
So, when would you say we'll get to 10x?
10x a human
AI,
being?
Yeah, 10x the human brain.
Oh, I'm not certain it ever happens. Okay. Candidly, I don't believe it happens. Mm. Okay. I am certain we will get to computers very soon that can do any one task that we do better than we do. That'll happen very quickly. But to be able to perform better than a human being at all tasks, I don't think, you know, I don't see it happening.
Okay. I want to go back to your question, to this issue you just raised about privacy. Do you trust governments more with data, or are you more concerned about private companies holding this data as you look at the future of AI development and privacy?
Wow, that's a tough question. Okay. There's no one in the world who trusts government less than I.
Okay. But you've also had some choice words for Google and Facebook well before we came on here. So
that being said, you know, we have issues related to social media, and they'll be related to all these AI and IoT systems, okay, where in many cases, particularly in social media, okay, the industry is not regulating itself, where we have the weaponization of social media that cuts to the question of, you know, whether we're able to conduct a democracy. So, I mean, this is pretty important stuff. Okay, and it's happening and in the places that it's happening, the people who are running the show know it's happening. And I mean, really, how many billions of dollars do you need? So industry is not regulating itself, and I think, and this is very unlike me, I think government has to step in and they have to provide the leadership, or else we're going to be very sad.
So this is on the collection of data by company, internet companies specifically.
Well, I think it's going to be all companies and all of these AI-related systems as it relates to personally identifiable information. We need to protect that.
So Europe has passed GDPR, which aims to do this. Is that a good model for the U.S.?
I think it's a good start. And Europe is way ahead of the U.S. in this. So we do a lot of work on GDPR. We're a leader in GDPR. We're deploying GDPR systems across Europe today. In a joint venture that we have with MasterCard and IBM, actually. But in the United States, we're just starting to recognize that it's a problem. I think that where we have situations where we have social media companies that are becoming more powerful than the governments that regulate them, that's a problem. Okay, and I think the governments will react, and I think they should react. And so I think this needs to become part of the public discourse. It needs to be openly discussed. I think there needs to be a discussion that includes the complete spectrum of viewpoints, not just what happens to be politically correct on name the TV channel this week. Okay, but it needs to be discussed. It's important. It needs to be addressed. And if it isn't, I think we'll all be very sorry.
But you have this interesting dilemma for social media companies and more broadly internet companies where they have the choice of using AI systems, which are hugely imperfect, to determine what is appropriate content, hate speech, etc., or humans. Regardless, these companies are becoming ministries of truth. But are you more comfortable with AI-based systems filtering through content and blocking certain, whether it's inappropriate images or content, or would you trust the human moderators more at this stage?
I think at the scale and the speed of which these data are being transferred today and the rate at which information is being promulgated and communicated, it's virtually impossible for human beings to keep up with it. Mm-hmm. We have to use machines. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to be, very careful about these issues related to bias. Bias is a very troubling problem, and I think you're kind of touching on it, okay? But I think we can, properly engineered, it has to be done by machines because the brain just can't deal with this kind of volume.
Mm-hmm. One question from the audience on this before we move on. Should platforms be held liable for the content that leads to violence and the enabling of hate groups? Major issue for Facebook, especially.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Should the platforms be held responsible for extremist content? For example, Europe has suggested that if, for example, people who are promoting Islamist terrorism or extremism are promoting those ideas through YouTube or on Facebook, perhaps the platforms themselves should be held legally liable for that content. Any strong views on whether that would hurt the internet?
That's a pretty slippery slope. I think the First Amendment is a pretty good idea, and I think that although I think it's not a pretty good idea. I think it's a great idea. Okay.
For the record,
it's a great idea, and I think that free speech is a very important thing, and I think it's very disappointing that, as we kind of power into the 21st century, that, free speech is, it's not being questioned. It's being more than questioned, in many of the college campuses today that were, violently for free speech in the 60s and 70s are now massively suppressing free speech. So I think suppressing free speech is a problem, and I think we should, I don't think we should hold the platforms accountable.
Okay. I want to switch gears a little bit. So one of the big debates in Silicon Valley is what the role should be of tech companies in helping offer services to the government and to the military specifically. Hugely contentious issue at companies like Google. Jeff Bezos recently weighed in saying that companies should be willing to work with their government because certainly Chinese companies are working with theirs. What's your take?
Jeff Bezos weighed in. Satya at Microsoft weighed in last week with a similar statement that said we will support the government in the government activities. I think this is, what's happening is really disappointing and really scary. This idea that large groups of people in Silicon Valley are saying they refuse to support the United States government and its activities related to helping support democracy, individual liberty, free speech around the world. And I think the people who are doing this are lacking a historical perspective. I think they're generally young. I think perhaps their exposure to history was through their, high school social studies book. And they put World War II, the 30 Years' War, and the Peloponnesian Wars kind of in the same category of stuff we don't need to think about. That's all ancient history, right? Well, World War II is not ancient history, and we live in this, we live in a shadow of World War II in this, kind of post-Westphalian structure that we have around the world. It's fascinating to me that people refuse to work with the United States government and yet freely consort with the Chinese.
And like Google with potentially offering search.
Yeah, like Google for certain, okay? They just made an announcement to that effect last week, and I'm not here to slam Google. These people are friends of mine, and they run a great company, but I think what's happening there with the employee pools is just staggering. This idea that we won't support the United States government, but we will work with the Chinese when we're engaged in absolute open warfare, okay, with the Chinese today as it relates to AI. And if you think it's anything short of warfare, I don't think it is. Okay, and to lose this battle is not going to go well. I think, Vladimir Putin said in 2017 that, whoever wins in AI rules the world. And I think it's true. And these people in China are not asleep at the switch.
Where is the most visible or interesting sign of that AI war? I mean, to most of us, we're hearing about a trade war on a day-to-day basis, not an AI war. Is that ultimately going to play out in weapon systems that use AI being developed? Or what's the most important frontier of this AI war, as you're calling it?
Well, unquestionably, the next war kind of takes place in cyberspace. Okay, this is where war will be done. Okay, will be conducted. But it's being done today, okay, in the weaponization of social media. You're seeing it in elections, in the penetration of our critical infrastructure. For example, Rebecca Smith writes in the Wall Street Journal quite frequently about bad actors, Russians, Chinese, North Koreans, who are penetrating our critical infrastructure like the grid and implanting viruses. Okay, and that when they enable these viruses, they can shut down the grid infrastructure. You shut down the grid infrastructure, power grid infrastructure of the United States, 90% of the population dies. They die of starvation or they die of dehydration.
In what time period? How long will it take?
Within a year, 90% of the people are dead. Mm. I mean, if you take out, I think, 9 specific transformers in the United States, the grid is down for a year. Everything stops. The grid, if you look at the Maslow's hierarchy of needs in Western civilization, the bottom rung is power.
But
for that, no security, no police, nothing on the store and Safeway. Okay, no water coming out of the tap.
No Amazon deliveries.
No Amazon deliveries. Imagine that. Even your Facebook won't work.
But people have been mostly worried about North Korea with an EMP attack. Do you think it's more likely to be China?
I think North Korea. You're looking at EMP, right? So EMP.
Right.
So EMP being a medium altitude or high altitude nuclear explosion that results in electromagnetic pulse that wipes out the grid. That would be the Korean fear. Okay, what Rebecca Smith writes about and documents well in the Wall Street Journal, and there's a book written by Ted Koppel called Lights Out. I think that I would recommend to you. where he documents very clearly that many bad actors, Iran, North Korea, Chinese, and the Russians, are penetrating the U.S. grid infrastructure every day. Like the Russians penetrated shut down the Ukrainian grid with an email, one email with an attachment. The person got the email. It appeared to become from the Ukraine utility regulatory agency. They clicked on the attachment. The attachment wiped out the reboot sequence on the SCADA system. SCADA is a supervisory control and data acquisition system. This is what operates all the switches in the grid infrastructure. And the lights went, all the power went down in the Ukraine. Now, the nice thing about the Ukraine is that their grid infrastructure was sufficiently antiquated that people could go out in trucks and turn on the switches and get it back on. In the United States, it's not going to work that way.
Mm.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So
that would be an example today of what's happening in cyber warfare. Mm. What's happening today with Facebook in the 2016 and hopefully not 2018 election cycle would be an example of cyber warfare. This is before we get to Star Wars, okay, which is what the future is about.
Absolutely. Back on this question of Silicon Valley's collaboration with or support of the U.S. military, your view is that these young people don't study history. Their view might be that there needs to be more rules governing the use of the most powerful weapons that the U.S. could possibly be creating with the help of AI. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely agree with that. Mm-hmm. There's no question. I mean, another aspect that I think these people don't appreciate is what they are doing is they are monetizing assets that were developed by the U.S. Department of Defense. I mean, the internet came from the U.S. Department of Defense. This was ARPANET, right? That became the internet. Look at the browser as we know it today. It was not invented by Google. It was invented by a ARPA supported research project at the University of Illinois at Urbana. Mm. Okay, so these are all if we look at the whole computer industry, as we think of it today, is a secondary effect of the space race, which was, John F. Kennedy. And that was a defense project when they had to, basically miniaturize things in order to deal with the Sputnik problem. So basically what's going on in Silicon Valley are people are monetizing investments that were made by the Department of Defense.
Well, and the Valley itself grew up thanks to World War II contracts with the government after World War II and during World War II, right? So the Valley has huge ties to the government. Of course, it strikes me that it's really interesting because the Chinese, there's no similar conversation happening about a question about whether or not to support the government. What would you like to see from America if we want to think forward toward really winning, if it's a zero-sum race, if winning in an AI, or at least investing more heavily? What should we be seeing from the U.S. government?
Well, I think one of the very important issues relates to immigration policy. We have a policy where we are spending massive amounts of taxpayer dollars educating very bright people from all over around the world at some of the world's best institutions, including the one that you attended, and training them in data science and nuclear energy and electrical engineering. And we give them their PhDs from Stanford, Harvard, Yale, wherever. And then we do not allow these people to work in the United States. And we make them go back to China, for example. This is insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, they should be stapling green cards to these diplomas, and to export this kind of human capital is crazy, As it relates, so there's a good place to start. I think that you know, this just needs to become a national imperative. And there is no leadership on this. I encourage you to go onto Wikipedia and read the 13th five-year plan from in China. It is all about the Internet of Things. It is all about the Internet of Energy. It is all about AI as a national imperative in China. And this is, and things work a little bit differently in China. You know, when these guys lay out the law, this is exactly what everybody does, right? But, you know, where's the leadership? You know, where is our leadership? Where is our Congress? Where is our White House? Where, I mean...
Well, they're saying to close down on immigration, yeah, right? So that's
There's nobody home. And so I think we need a national imperative, and it needs to be, if we lose this battle that's going on in AI, we will be very unhappy.
How will we know if we lost?
We'll all be speaking Mandarin.
Seriously, will it be a cyber attack that we lose? Is it that we're? How will we know? I know you never know these things until it's too late. But what will the turning point be in history when it's clear that America lost in AI?
I don't know what will incite the next war. Whether it will be an accident in the South China Sea, or somebody will misinterpret a signal where they think that some missiles have been launched when in fact no missiles have been launched. And maybe there was no human in the loop, right? Mm-hmm. So we had, machine to machine, automated decisions, and that results in global thermonuclear war. So I'm not certain when it happens and how it happens, but I am, very active in this dialogue with the community in Washington, D.C. And I think, I had dinner last night with the commander of the Army Futures Command. And I don't know when it happens and how it happens, but this will be the essential tool set that we need to prevail.
What would you do?
Or to avoid it happening, more importantly, to avoid it happening.
A war. What would you do if you were president to enhance the U.S.'s AI position besides changing immigration policy?
I would set an imperative. I would use the bully pulpit and budget to set a goal. Mm-hmm. I would spend, let's look at cybersecurity, critical infrastructure cybersecurity. It can be protected. I mean, compared to the Manhattan Project, this is a relatively small project. And I would say this is order of magnitude less. This is a solvable problem. All it takes is will, okay, commitment, direction, and money. And we could secure the critical infrastructure of the United States. So this would be a good first step.
I have a question from the audience. How important is it to monitor the design of AI-based applications by the government? This gets to the issue of transparency and accountability.
Okay, I think the question is, how important is it for the government to monitor the development of AI?
You could actually ask either question, but choose which one.
Not certain.
Sure. Which
question is it? You tell me and I'll answer.
I think it's AI-based applications designed by the government. What kind of accountability is there? Public accountability. It gets to the question of even precision medicine and healthcare with our healthcare system, right? If in an environment like the UK.
One, we're dealing with defense systems and intelligence systems, and the other we're dealing with, I think the fact of the matter is that, I think there is a need for oversight in defense. I think we have that in the Defense Committee. I think we have it in the Intelligence Committee. So there is, we do have civilian oversight of the military, and I think that needs to be enforced and it needs to continue. This other idea of, do we need the government to regulate AI algorithms, which was, I think, first promulgated by my friend Elon Musk, I think is completely whacked. Number one, I think it's very difficult to determine when does an algorithm become AI? I'm not certain anybody can really define that line. Okay, and the idea that we're going to to do this, that we're going to have some sort of Food and Drug Administration that is going to which we are going to submit our algorithms for approval before we publish them. I mean, it's basically all innovation comes to a screeching halt. So that idea, I think, is a little whacked. But I do think that we need to have civilian oversight of the military. I think we do have civilian oversight of the military, and I think...
So what kind of regulation do we need when it comes to AI? You had, you know, you felt like there we need to see more regulation when it comes to data privacy and social networks and the internet. Do you feel like there needs to be any kind of government involvement when it comes to regulating any part of AI, whether it's self-driving cars or predictive analytics and health or any of these other applications of AI?
Well, absolutely. And again, I'm going to go to the inverse of that question first. As it relates to government AI systems and defense-related AI systems, I think we simply cannot have systems where AI is making the call, okay? Where AI is making the decision, for example, to pull the trigger, the kill decision without a human in the loop. There's a book out there called Army of None about the ethics of this subject. And as recently as 1983, the Soviets on their detection systems saw a mass number of missiles coming from the United States into the Soviet Union. And the general in charge looked at it and they had very high levels of certainty that this was true. The missiles were coming across the Atlantic or across, I guess, the North Pole, probably from Montana or where they come from, headed into the Soviet Union. And, it was very clear what his instructions were. And had it been a machine, the machine would have followed these instructions. This actually happened in 1983. And something didn't seem right. And so he went out and checked on the DEVCON level of the United States, and the DEVCON level was 1. And he says it's impossible that these guys are launching a thermonuclear war with DEVCON level 1. So he ignored it and saved the world. Okay, and, had this been a machine making this decision, we wouldn't be here today. And so I think that there needs to be a human in the loop or we have a big problem. As it relates to the regulation of systems, does the government need to be involved? Yes, they do. In precision medicine, in automated vehicles, I think, everybody thinks it's a foregone conclusion that autonomous driving is going to be here tomorrow. I'm not sure that's true. I mean, can this Google car make it through Palo Alto without killing anybody? It can. Okay, but what is going to happen when the driver of this vehicle needs to make a decision that human beings have to make? And that is, you're going at a high rate of speed, you're in a certain situation, and somebody is going to die. It's the driver, it's the old man in the cane on the left side, or it's the baby in the carriage on the right, but somebody's gonna die. Now, a human being can make that decision and get away with it. No matter what decision the computer makes, it's gonna be wrong. And it's gonna be, the National Transportation Safety Board's gonna be all over it the next day. And so, I'm not certain how we're gonna deal with that kind of problem. But yes, the government absolutely needs to be involved in regulating these systems, in setting the rules for ethics, in setting the rules for guidelines, and that's what I believe.
The Valley, you mentioned self-driving cars, and I think the Valley is full of technologies that people predict are around the corner but are going to be farther out, self-driving cars being one of them. What's a technology that people think is farther away than you think it is, that you think is going to arrive here sooner than...
Well, we've talked about this, the singularity, the idea that computers will become smarter than human beings. I think that's a stretch.
What's something that you think isn't a stretch that's going to happen sooner than people anticipate?
I think, AI in every aspect of our lives, in travel, transportation, communications, consumer packaged goods, retailing, driving, AI, and the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is just this massive vector growing exponentially that is going to have a large impact.
And how, for those who know the acronym of IoT but don't know how AI and IoT interact, what kind of, why is IoT significant for AI or vice versa?
Okay, so the Internet of Things, we generally think of that as sensors, where we can remotely sense the state of devices in real time or near real time. An example would be a smart meter, like when, at least when I grew up, okay, somebody used to drive by once a month in a truck and go get out of the vehicle and go write down the number on the meter and subtract, you know, and subtract what happened in the number that was there 30 days before, and that's how they determined how many kilowatt hours we'd consume in our house. Well, today, with a smart meter, we can remotely sense the state of these devices, you know, every minute or every 15 minutes. And so that would be an example of a sensor. A Fitbit would be an example of a sensor. And if it's got Bluetooth, it communicates our pulse. Human beings, I think, will be highly sensored in the next decade, where we'll be able to detect, pulse, heart arrhythmia, blood chemistry, brain waves, whatever it might be, at maybe 1 hertz cycles, or we'll have these devices embedded in our gut, in our brain, and we'll be wearing them. Now, these data, for example, the grid is an example where 2 trillion, grid is the largest, most complex machine ever built, and this is how we generate and distribute power. It was designed by Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse a little over 100 years ago. Now, this decade, we're deploying this thing called the smart grid, where we're taking all of the devices in the grid infrastructure, transformers, substations, reclosers, capacitance banks, smart meters, thermostats, vibration sensors on nuclear reactors, and we're putting sensors on these devices so we can remotely sense their state in real time. And now using deploying systems, by taking all of the data that are generated from these sensors, sometimes some at 15-minute intervals, some once a day, and some at 60 hertz cycles, that would be 60 times a second, we can aggregate those data, apply AI, and dramatically increase the efficiency, increase the reliability, decrease the cost, and reduce the greenhouse gas footprint of power generation and delivery. And so the world is safer, the world is cleaner, and energy is cheaper. Now, so far this decade, we've deployed about 35 billion sensors. So far this century, in the last 18 years, okay, we've deployed about 35 billion sensors across the value chains of healthcare, travel, transportation, power, oil and gas, what have you. We'll put out another 20 billion sensors in the next 10 years. And we think about this. We found that there was a guy, a scientist at Xerox PARC by the name of Bob Metcalf, who invented this thing called Ethernet. Turned out to be pretty useful. And he found that if you connected computers together in a network, that the whole was much more powerful than the sum of its parts. And he described that as Metcalf's law. And he described the power of the network as a square of the number of nodes that you connected. So now, when we look at the Internet of Things, mostly we think about it as sensors. But when we connect, these sensors are fully connected, as they will be fully connected, and we have 50 billion of them. Well, 50 billion, I think, is 10 to the 21st. So basically, all of these sensors, let's think about what they are. They're computers. They have computational capacity, they have storage capacity, and they have communications capacity. They're computers.
And how is the nature of sensors going to change? So is every surface going to be a sensor in the future, do you think?
Everything will be sensored. But just let me just finish. There's one more sentence to this. So what we have is a computing platform more powerful. It's a computing platform. It's with the power of 10 to the 21st. And so we have basically IoT and AI are just two sides of the same coin. I think they're the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You all followed that, right? Good. As AI, a question from the audience, as AI increases the ability to mimic human thought process, what are the social and emotional implications? Philosopher Siebel.
I'm not certain that I'm aware of any computers that are mimicking the human thought process. So that's outside of my league.
And so you disagree with the idea that AI systems will be 10x, but at some point there will be emotional dimensions to AI systems. We're already starting to see it with therapy bots, right? I mean, it's very basic level, but you're able to talk virtually with a bot that shows a bit of empathy. When you say, I'm sad, I'm up at 4 a.m. and no one else is up, the bot responds saying, I'm so sorry, what's wrong? So you see a little bit of that. Play it out for me. Do you think, I mean, you mentioned Ex Machina, the movie, so that's far away, but do you think that AI will change, at the very least, the nature of human relationships, if not human relationships with AI systems?
Well, to the extent that we have companions that are computers, I'm not sure this bodes well. And if you even look at the impact of social media on young people, and you read the studies, I mean, it's hugely deleterious. I mean, and even the rate of, versus 20 years ago today, the number of people who go through high school without ever having a date. Okay, people who, the people's sense of, depression, their sense of self-worth, suicide rates. They have this phenomenon in Japan due to social media that they call the celibacy syndrome, where, people, the data are that these are people 16 to 26 years old, okay, 26% of males and 46% of females in Japan in that age group have no interest in sex. I mean, everybody's doing this. I mean, so I think that the idea that our companion becomes this bot, I'm not certain this bodes well for... I'm not certain I want to live there.
I'll leave it there. Parts of the U.S., another question from the audience. Parts of the U.S. are being left behind when it comes to technology and the AI revolution. We see the impact in government policies and politicians. How do we bring these areas and people along?
I think it's a very important subject. I don't have an answer, and it needs to get to the top of the agenda, and it needs to be discussed. Because as it relates to this, this kind of knowledge economy that we're developing, where, in order to play the game, you need to, have studied computer science at Stanford. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people left behind, and a lot of jobs are going to be eliminated, and I don't have an answer, but I know it's a problem, and we need to begin to anticipate it. I think AI we think about the fact, we're talking about adding, increasing the gross domestic product of the planet by 20% in a very short period of time. This is analogous to the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution was spawned by the invention of the Jacquard loom and then the steam engine. And I think most people would think the Industrial Revolution was a good thing. But what were negative consequences that are a direct line from the invention of the Jacquard loom and the steam engine? Well, that would include communism, child labor, and World War I. And not so good, right? And so I think that we will have... there are going to be similar deleterious consequences from this new generation of technologies that if we don't anticipate them and deal with them, we're going to have to live with the consequences. Mm.
What do you think? We have another question on the global geopolitical order. What cyber offensives do you think Putin is currently running against the U.S.? And what should we do about it?
Oh, I think that Putin is, first of all, I don't think Russia is a winner in the long run in AI. I don't think they play.
Why?
Okay? They're not a very big economy. Okay, they're very bright. I mean, you look at the GDP of of the Soviet Union. It's really not very substantial. They don't have the resources. I don't think they can play the game. But I think China, they can play the game. That being said, okay, what is Russia doing today? Okay, in cyber warfare that is taking place. Well, number one is using social media to try to manipulate our election process. Hard stop. That's happening. It's happening at mass level. Okay, then as it relates, the Russians are very active in penetrating critical infrastructure, placing viruses there, placing bots there, that when they turn on, they can disable the critical infrastructure. So they're doing it. They're doing it today. They're doing it. It's well known. It's well documented. And it is a form of war.
Mm. And how much faith do you have that our country and companies are doing enough to counteract it?
I'm absolutely certain that we are not. Okay, I have some familiarity with the utilities in the United States and how they operate. Actually, a lot of familiarity, and I think we're doing virtually nothing about it. Mm. So I think that we are highly vulnerable, and I think the good news is, you know, I think for the Russians to turn off the lights on the United States wouldn't serve them well right now.
But it did seem to serve them well interfering on social media.
It did. And I'm confident they're doing it today.
How do you think that AI is going to change the nature of competition within industries? We see in e-commerce and retail, a company like Amazon harness AI to achieve a scale that many never anticipated. Do you think it's going to cause a similar reshuffling in other industries beyond the internet sector, where the big only get bigger in healthcare, you name it?
It's a great question. There's a concept that is being very actively kicked around in the CEO suites and the boardrooms of the world today called digital transformation. For a while, I couldn't figure out what these people were talking about. Like, as opposed to what? As opposed to analog transformation? So I kept on listening and listening and trying to figure out what was going on. And why was the CEO involved? I mean, you know, in the information technology business from the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, through the end of the 20th century, you know, the CEO was never involved in information technology decisions. This was always done. These are decisions made by, you know, the CIO in selecting technologies. And all of a sudden now the CEO is out visiting, you know, actively out visiting companies all around the world and in Silicon Valley with their management teams, pounding on the table, demanding this thing called digital transformation. So what is going on and where did the CEO come from? Well, what's the impact? Well, what is happening? We're in... There's a mass extinction event, okay, taking place in the corporate world. Okay, since 2000, okay, in the last 18 years, 50% of the Fortune 500 companies have disappeared from the planet. Okay, they've gone bankrupt, they've been purchased, they've merged, they're gone. Where is Westinghouse? Where is Kodak? Where is Sears? Where is General Electric? I mean, next could be IBM. I mean, they're just gone. Who would think of the idea that Kodak could be gone or Westinghouse could be? 50% of them are gone. Okay, and then we have people like John Chambers who predict that in the next 10 years, 70% of the companies that remain will be gone. Now, there's an analog out of, you know, evolutionary biology. You know, for those of you who, you know, read, you know, well, Darwin thought in natural selection with evolution of species. He thought this was a continuous event, okay? And the problem was, and this was, he wrote, I think, you know, in the 1860s or whenever it was, when he talked about natural selection. And he thought it was a continuous event, but nobody could explain the discontinuities in the fossil records. And it wasn't until 1972 that an evolutionary biologist by the name of Stephen Gould described it in a term called punctuated equilibrium. And he said, well, evolution isn't a continuous event. It's highly discontinuous. And if we look at, the planet's been around for about 3 billion years. And then he describes in the last 400 million years alone, there's been 6 mass extinction events. The most recent being this KT extinction that you all know about when this meteor hit in the Yucatan and all the volcanoes erupted and there was climate change. Well, 85% of the species on Earth just disappeared. And then one of the species that disappeared that was kind of dominant at the time, and they've been on the planet for about 150 million years, were the dinosaurs. Well, that turned out to be pretty good for us because mammals evolved, a new DNA, a new species evolved with new DNA, and it was mammals that filled the space that the dinosaurs had, and so it worked out well. Now, we're seeing a similar situation in the corporate world. We talk about companies with new DNA, the Ubers, the Teslas, the Amazons. And what is this all about? Uber, it's all about AI and IoT. No cars, no drivers, and they're completely transforming the that business. Or Tesla. I don't know whether Tesla is going to ultimately be successful or not, but what is Tesla? AI, IoT, cloud computing on wheels. And whether Tesla succeeds or not, they are most certainly going to disrupt the automotive business. How about Amazon? Amazon, with 1/5 of the sales of Walmart, has twice the market cap. And it's all about AI and IoT focused at retailing. And if you're Walmart looking down the barrel of the gun coming from Amazon, you're in a world of hurt. So I think we have a massively disruptive event taking place in the global business community of companies that will candidly either adopt or cease to exist. We've closed 8,000 retail outlets in the United States last year alone. And so there's a mass disruption event going on between the haves and have-nots in the corporate world. And
it's big. Yeah, because one of the things that really interests us at The Economist is that you've seen all these businesses thrive on network effects. The more people use them, the more useful they become. They increase their size. The question is, will AI do this in a turbocharged way for businesses? Because they collect more data, they're more useful, they're able to be cheaper. And so you see what's happened in the internet world and others, where it's the haves and the have-nots, as you point out, going to all these other legacy industries and creating a form of corporate inequality that will ultimately play out in consumer prices and lack of choice.
I think the answer is absolutely. And it will happen in banking. It'll happen in transportation. It'll happen in the automotive business. It'll happen in the medical industry. And this is going to be highly disruptive, and lots of companies will cease to exist. Well, I guess Sears is the most recent example that's disappeared, right?
I want to ask you, we only have a few minutes left. I want to ask you about entrepreneurship. So we've heard about a lot of reasons to leave this room despairing about the state of the world and our future. I'm wondering if entrepreneurship should make us more optimistic or pessimistic. And some people feel like the Googles of the world, Amazons, Facebooks, cast such a shadow that it's very difficult to innovate. You're obviously in a position where you are running a company that you founded. So I imagine you feel optimistic about your own prospects. But what about more broadly for entrepreneurs in the Bay Area today?
First, to the extent that I am the harbinger of doom and gloom, don't buy it, okay? I see the world consisting of glasses that are half full. I see nothing but opportunity, okay? And I am very optimistic. I just think we need to recognize that these are issues that we need to deal with. We can't pretend that they don't exist. Okay, deals with personal privacy, security, cybersecurity. We need to address them, and I think we will address them. I think that the United States and Western civilization has a knack for recognizing problems and innovating and solving them. So I'm just saying we need to solve them. I think the outcome is good. As it relates to innovation, as it relates to the opportunity for entrepreneurs, the opportunity to innovate, to create companies, to organize people, I think the opportunities have never been greater than they are today. Okay, they've never been greater. I think that, you know, it used to be you needed a capital to buy computers, and you buy a computer room. Today, you know, for $25, you have access to, you know, the largest computer network ever conceived. Infinite storage, infinite computing capacity. I think we have access to, you know, trained human capital like has never existed before. I think we have markets that are highly receptive to innovative and new technologies. So I think the opportunities have never been greater for entrepreneurs. And I think that I expect to see this to continue to accelerate. And I think we're seeing it in Silicon Valley. We're seeing it in Austin. We're seeing it in New York City. And I think that, you know, I'm extremely optimistic about that, and it's really fun to watch all these new companies come into existence.
And if you were starting your career over again, would you build Siebel Systems in the Bay Area today?
I would build Siebel. So I would, if I were to do Oracle, I would do it in the Bay Area. At Siebel, I'd do it in the Bay Area. Or C3, I would do it in the Bay Area. You find few places in the world with this concentration of energy, creativity, incredibly high energy, well-educated human capital, access to capital, people who are willing to take risk. And so I think this is this is just a cauldron, a hotbed of innovation. And if I were to start a company in 2019, which I assure you I will not do, I would do it right here.
And what's something you wish you had known when you were starting out that would be useful to entrepreneurs today?
I think that over the years, I developed an increasing respect for the importance of human capital, for the need to surround yourself, which in my case is particularly easy, with people who are smarter than me. To build. You know, and it's a little bit harder today than it used to be because the workforce is more complex with baby boomers and millennials and post-millennials. But to get, you know, really talented, you know, I think, whereas a lot of people want to focus on science, I think, and technology, I think focusing on human capital and culture and motivating people and, you know, finding a common thread that takes a large group of talented people and gets them to work in synchrony to accomplish something great. And I think that I have more and more respect and for the need to do that.
Mm-hmm. One more question for you, and then unfortunately we're out of time. One of the themes of this conversation has been the role of the tech community in working with government in America to make positive change. How much faith do you have in this environment that's polarized, where we're seeing a lot of people rightly or wrongly blame tech companies for a variety of ills? To what extent do you think that technologists and tech executives are going to be involved in providing solutions for society's ills?
Oh, I think the tech community will rise to the occasion. They will provide the solutions. They will work with governments that support liberty, and individual freedom and democracy, and people will do the right thing.
Okay, that's a good place to end. Thank you. So one last thing I have to close. So Tom Siebel, thank you so much, founder and CEO of C3. We also thank everyone else who's here, the audience, television, and the internet. I'm Alexandra Sewich Bass of The Economist, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place you're in the know, is adjourned.